Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. With the 14th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attack approaching this Friday, we'll hear a talk by Chris Peranto, former Army Ranger, 2nd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, who has worked with the government's global response staff conducting low-profile security in high-threat environments around the world. Mr. Peranto was in Benghazi as part of the CIA Annex security team on the night of September 11, 2012, when it came under attack by Islamic terrorists. Peranto and his team defended the Annex for 13 hours, saving over 20 lives in the process. Tragically, the lives of four Americans were lost that night: U.S. Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens, U.S. Foreign Service Information Management Officer Sean Smith, and two CIA contractors, Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty. Mr. Peranto's story is told in the book 13 Hours in Benghazi, written by Mitchell Zukoff and co-authored with Peranto and his surviving Annex security team members. This program, presented by the Washington County Historical Association and Patriotic Productions, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, June 2, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Washington County Historical Association, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is retired Air Force General Carl Lorenzen, currently a member of the Washington County Board of Supervisors.
I'm going to start out by reading an excerpt from Mitchell Zukoff's book. And in his book, 13 Hours in Benghazi, and I quote, Zukoff wrote, "A bloodthirsty mob bore down on the United States' poorly defended diplomatic post in Benghazi, Libya. Besieged American envoys and staffers withdrew to a locked room as fire set by the attackers drew closer. The Americans prayed and appealed for rescue, calling home to Washington and nearby allies. If no help came, they feared one of three fates. They'd be killed by the invaders, suffocate from smoke, or be roasted alive. In the meantime, they'd fight." The date? June 5th, 1967. Unquote. Well, a lot has changed since that day in 1967. The Vietnam War ended, and many conflicts, too numerous to mention, have sent our young men and women into harm's way. Fast forward, September 11th, 2001, and the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. We are here tonight to remember and pay honor to the many young men and women who have given the ultimate sacrifice of their lives in conflict since September 11th, 2001. Fast forward again to September 11th, 2012, the 11th anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks. 45 years had passed from the first attack on our diplomatic post in Benghazi in 1967, and yet another mob attacked our diplomatic outpost in Benghazi, Libya, and those there pleaded for rescue. A group of former Navy SEALs, Marines, and an Army Ranger courageously went to the aid of Ambassador Stevens and some 20 men and women assigned to the U.S. consulate. We are honored to hear firsthand the events of September 11, 2012, in Benghazi, Libya, as told by a lead member of the CIA Global Response Staff Team. Now, Chris Peranto served on active duty as a member of the U.S. Army's 2nd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, and as a member of the U.S. Special Forces. Chris served as lead security for two ambassadors to Iraq, including Ambassador Bremer. Chris has been a lead member in high-threat, low-profile security for over 18 years. I thank Chris for his service, both as a Ranger and as a JRS operative. I consider him to be more than a great American. He is a great American hero. Ladies and gentlemen, I present Chris Peranto. Chris.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, 9/11/2012, the day comes. And so most of the day, Ambassador Stevens is staying in. We know he is. Because the State Department guys, Scott Wicklund, Alec Henderson, and Dave Ubin, heroes in their own right. They're great guys. Those are the State Department security officers. Great guys. They were very limited in how they could get outside and get and travel around the city. So they utilized us because we had free rein to go wherever we wanted to do, whatever we wanted to do, to go sit in places, to go eat at places. So we were going out and recon in areas that the ambassador was going to go the next day. So throughout the day, we're doing movements throughout the city. Myself and Dave Benton were on QRF, Quick Reaction Force. So basically, we're monitoring atmospheric throughout the city. We're making sure that there's no protests going on in the city. We're making sure there's no videos that might instigate a protest going on in the city. We're making sure that there are no terrorist activities going on in parts of the city, so we can tell our guys that are out going out and doing their operations to stay out of specific areas. It's actually very quiet. For Benghazi standards, it's very quiet that day. Nobody's shooting at us. There's no attacks. There's nothing that is supposed to be coming towards us that day. Evening comes, and it's 9/11/2012. It's around 9 o'clock. And I remember Ty Woods passed away that night. Ty called me on the radio, and he says, "Hey, Tano, we're coming back. We're going to stop by." Tano, that's my call sign, for all you don't know. Tano, we're going to stop by the State Department compound, check on the guys, because we did that periodically at night because they had such a huge facility. It's 8 acres large. There was only 6 of them on the facility, very lightly defended. And we said, "Hey, we're gonna come check on you." And Ty, I remember Ty Rogering and saying that to Dave Ubin. Dave came across the radio and said, "No, we're good. You guys go ahead and go on home." Ty said, "All right, Roger that." I heard him come across the radio saying he was going to come back to our base, which was the annex. And he ended up driving still right in front of the consulate at 9 o'clock that night, reporting back to me that everything was quiet and that he was coming home. "And Roger, come on home." At that same time, Mark Ozgeis is leaving and going on an operation with one of our case officers out in town. And Mark, I remember coming up to me and asking me if there was any places he needed to stay out of because of possible attacks. I said, "No, there's nothing going on today. Nothing is happening." I said, "There's something going on in Egypt, but that's 2,000 miles away. And unless you're driving to Egypt, don't worry about it." I said, so he headed out the door. Ty got back. 9:10, he rolls in the gate. 9:32. And I remember because I looked at my watch because I hated being called at night. I couldn't stand being called by the superiors at night. 9:32 came across the radio, and we got a call that all jurists needed to muster in the team room. Our team leader, a staff TL, which was the guy that was in charge of us, which had no military experience at all, but he still was going to be in charge of all the guys that have special operations experience. That's typical government for you. He calls us on the radio, and he says, "Hey, all jurists need to report to the team room." Now, it was very nonchalant, just like that. There was no sense of urgency in his voice. So DB looked at me, and again, this is a whole other book I could write about myself and how much jackassery I used to get into and how much I used to make fun of people. But DB looks at me and goes, "Tano, what'd you do now?" Because normally I would have done something to somebody to get called in. And again, that's a whole other story, and if I have a few more beers after this is over, I'll tell you all about them. I said, "DB," I said, "Dave, I didn't do anything, man. I swear, I did nothing." Dave had known me for 10 years. He'd actually saved me in Iraq and Afghanistan twice. And he was with me in Blackwater when we first started. I mean, we'd been through everything together. And 30 seconds later, now an urgent call, very urgent, comes across radio and says, "All GRS, we need you in the team room now." I remember looked at Dave, and man, I'm even getting goosebumps right now. I looked at him, and I go, "Man, all right, we could do something fun tonight." And I said it just like that, because you can only practice so long. I mean, come on, the Huskers can't practice for 2 years and never get to play a game. You know, we hadn't gotten anything for a few months. Well, actually for about 6 months. So, I know I've got him. We've been through stuff before. He's got my back. And we get out the door, and immediately as we walk out the annex, out of our barracks, we lived in a little guest house. You could see the tracers. You could hear the firefight going on. And that's the thing, is you can become so acclimated to everything. Even when we're inside and we're hearing firing going on in the distance, we're so used to it that we're not thinking anything of it. And until we walk out the door and you start seeing those tracers bounce, you're starting to see the firing, and you're looking in the distance, you're going, "Holy crap, that's where the consulate's at. that concert's under attack, and you're seeing those. That is, I'll be honest, that's more gorgeous than any fireworks you'll ever see. If you ever get a chance to see a firefight from far away, I don't want to get in it. It's incredible. And it's what guys like myself live for. And like an orchestra, my team, Jack Silva, John Tig Tigan, Tyrone Woods, Dave Benton, and myself, we are already knowing what we need to do. We already have been trained to get to where we need to go and get our positioning of our vehicles, get our weapon systems. Nothing needs to be said because of all the special operations experience we had and all the experience we had working together and then the experience and the faith that we had in each other. And it was beautiful. And I remember going up to our team leader, and I knew what was going on, but I gave him the courtesy, and I said, hey, what's going on? And he looked at me, goes, the concert's under attack, roger that. I went in and got my machine gun. I got my rifle. I got my helmet. I got my NODs. Sorry, I can't give you the nomenclature of my night vision. I'd been, between my trips, I'd actually not been going home. I'd been going on ships and fighting pirates off the coast of Somalia. I know that sounds funny, huh? Fighting Jack Sparrow and pirates. Seriously. No, but seriously, I wouldn't go home. I like my job, so I'd contract off ships. After Captain Phillips got attacked, my team, six guys, we would go ride ships in between. So I had my shorts on, and I just, and in general, I'm sorry, I just never thought those shorts, I never thought this piece of cloth was going to save my life. And if I was going to get in a firefight, I was going to be comfortable. So I was wearing shorts, put my armor on, ran back out to the car, and the car's already set up. Everybody's ready to go. Ty looks at me, and Ty was a big dude. Ty looked like Leonidas, and he looks at me, gives me a thumbs up, winks at me, and I'm like, yes, let's go get some. And I go back to our TL, and I said, hey, we're ready to go. This is 5 minutes. It's 9:37 now. And I remember the team leader was on his phone. Our chief of base, Bob, was standing behind him, and Bob looked at the team leader and says, you tell them they need to wait. It's like, okay. And now, I kind of took it as a slap in the face because basically, now, you're not Bob. I'm just saying, Bob's here, the team leader's here, I'm here. And instead of Bob looking at me and telling me that I need to wait, he tells the team leader to tell me that I need to wait. So that's kind of a slap in the face, but hey, that's how it is. We're contractors, they're staff, you know, as far as they're concerned, we're Walmart security guards. All right, roger that, we'll wait. I remember getting on my radio, walking back to the vehicle, hey guys, we need to wait. Now, keep in mind, we share the same radio frequencies with State Department guys, so we can hear them calling us on the radio. Our friends, and they're friends of ours, Dave and Scott and Alec are friends of ours, saying, we need you guys here now. We're under attack. We can see the firefight. We can hear the explosions. RPGs, they aren't quiet when they hit. You know, the rat-a-tat-tat of a PKM and the NAK-47s are like Gunny Highway says. They make distinct sounds when they're fired at you. And you can hear everything going. Well, I remember I get in the car with Dave, and I said, hey, we got to wait. You know, he kind of shrugs his shoulder. We give our leadership the benefit of the doubt with those first 5 minutes, because I was an officer at one time in the military. I was enlisted, too, to all you enlisted guys, so don't give me any crap about being just an officer. I was enlisted. I was a sergeant before I became an officer. But I would have done the same thing. I figured he's trying to get air support or something, because there's only six of us in this country that we know of. Well, he wasn't. So 5 more minutes go by, and the calls across the radio are getting more frantic. Like, guys, we need you guys here. We're taking heavy fire. We can hear the firefight still going on. We can hear them, that they're getting their butts handed to them. And they just got caught off guard. I'm not saying anything bad against State Department, the Scott and Alec and Dave. They just got caught off guard. It happens. Another 5 minutes go by, so now it's 10 minutes. Now it's 15 from when the original call came in. And I remember seeing Tig get out of the vehicle, and he gets out, and he goes to Bobby, says, we need to go now. We're losing the initiative. And he's fired up, and I can see him. I'm looking right at him. And Bob, here's the infamous words, and I don't know how many more times I got to say it, but I'm probably going to have to say it all the way up to the election of next year. Bob looks at him and says, you guys need to stand down. That's where the stand down order came from. That stand down order to us. And I remember Tig got in the vehicle and he goes, hey, we got to stand down. I remember Tig saying he's not going to let us go again. Bob had already done that to us twice for our own guys that got wrapped up in the city twice. He made us wait and stand down. And luckily, our own guys bluffed their way out of situations. But in this case, these guys weren't bluffing out of anything. And now it's 15 minutes. And any of y'all that have been in a firefight before know 15 minutes in a firefight is forever. Well, 10 more minutes go by. It's been 25 minutes now. And finally, Scott or Alec, and I couldn't remember because the duress in the voice, like I couldn't understand. I want to say it was Alec. He came across right and says, if you guys don't get here, we're going to die. And those are quoted. That's verbatim. And I remember I got out of the car. I looked at Dave. He looked at me. He gave me that look like we need to go. And I got out, got to our GRS team leader, and I said, get in the effing car. We're going. And, you know, it really wasn't asking anymore. Our guys are dying. We never got the okay to go. Got our team leader in the car. And this is a little funny point. I want to just kind of I make jokes because I think dealing with adversity is important. And sometimes you got to laugh at when you get into adversity. We'd been through a lot of adversity just in that first 30 minutes, and we held it together. I remember that whenever I had to link up with an indigenous force before, which I thought we might have to, which was the 17th February Martyrs Brigade, that we might have to talk to them. And I didn't speak the language well enough. So I went up to our interpreter, and this guy is a hero. This guy's more a hero than any of us. A little interpreter. He's 60 years old. He's Egyptian. He looks like Bob Newhart. He's about this tall. Awesome guy. He's incredible. He's not a combat terp. There's differences. I had a combat terp in Iraq that carried a cattle prod. He used to cattle prod people, and I had no problem with him doing that because there were some situations where he needed to, and it was better for them to get cattle prodded than shot. But this guy, he comes up to me, and I grab him. I said, Hey, Henry, I said, we need you, buddy. I said, we're going to have to link up with an indigenous force. I don't want a blue on green. I don't want a friendly fire incident. I need you. And he looks at me and he goes, Mr. Tano, I'm not weapons qualified. And I remember I grabbed my pistol. I handed it to him. I said, you are now. Go get your stuff. And he didn't say a word. He didn't argue. He said, yes, sir. And he went and got his gear. And he's not a combat terp, so his gear doesn't fit him well enough. So he comes walking out, and he's head jingling because his Kevlar's not fitting him. His armor's hanging down, and he looked like a turtle coming out. And it was the funniest. And I was laughing. I was in all that. I'm laughing. I'm just laughing because he looks like the cutest little thing coming out. But, you know, this guy's a hero because he didn't have to go. We had to go. That's our job. He didn't have to, and he went didn't argue a bit. And he got his stuff on. He came right back out, got in the vehicle. I put around the chamber of his pistol that I gave him. I gave him some extra mags, and I said, just don't shoot me in the back while we're driving over there. We got in the car, and we left. And that was out the gate. And that was 30 minutes, approximately 30 minutes since we got the call. Now, for sake of me not having enough time, I'm going to skip a little bit. But basically, we drove part of the way there. Now, the media, and you don't get this from any of the news organizations, and I'm just telling you now, we weren't able to drive all the way on the compound. We actually got halfway there, and we had to pull over the side of the road, and we actually had to get out and go on foot. Now, when we got to the side of the road that we were going to turn and make a turn to go to the consulate, we did end up linking up with who we thought was the 17th February Martyrs Brigade. This was the company that was contracted to fight and protect the State Department compound, which has later been determined that they are actually part of Ansar Sharia, and they are a terrorist organization, so worst outsourcing of security ever, I think. But we get up there, and they're like cats. They're herding. They're everywhere. And I just remember looking at DB going, Dave going, man, I can't believe we waited 30 minutes for this. We get out of the car, and as soon as we get out of the car, you can start hearing the cracking. And all y'all know that you that have been fired at close range before, that crack means that bullet's breaking the sound barrier. So just so you know, when you hear that crack, that means the bullet's snapping. That means it's breaking the sound barrier, and that means it's close. It doesn't get any closer than that. And that should just get you fired up, because that did me. They were firing like, no, you didn't. No, you are not fired. You are not firing at us. And that snapping's going out, and it's so motivating, because you're dealing with all this adversity coming up. People are trying to stop you from saving your buddies, and you're getting shot at, and all it's doing is just making you Well, it's making me and making the rest of the guys more ready to go and more ready to get it on and happy. It really is. I know it's weird. I'm not trying to be sadistic. Just saying it just is making you want to get there and help your buddies. Well, we get out of the vehicles and we start moving on foot. In the meantime, Tig, Tig did fantastic job. He grabbed a 40 millimeter grenade launcher and he started shooting it down at some for these firing positions. And when you hear your buddy starting to shoot that thing down, that thump, and then when it hits the big explosion, that gets you more confidence in the world. And I remember me and DB just started jumping fences. And these fences are 7 to 8 foot to tall, and we're just climbing them. And I'm forgetting I'm in shorts, and I'm forgetting I'm also 42 years old, and I'm just trying to get over the top of these things. And it's hard. But I also went back. Again, I've dealt with adversity before. I've been through this at Ranger School. I've been punished and tortured, I guess you could say, as a Ranger private. I can do this again. That's all I was thinking in my head. And I know that's all DB was thinking. He was a force recon sniper, and that's all he was thinking in his head. He's thinking, man, this is terrible, but I've done it before. I can muscle my way through it, and forgot about it. The pain went away. It's like mission on. And media doesn't tell you this. Long story short, we managed to get there on foot, and it took us almost another 25 minutes to go 400 meters to try to fight our way onto that objective and climb all these walls and finally link up in the middle of the compound. Once we got to the middle of the consulate, it was just like you see on TV. It was burning. It was on fire. There was smoke everywhere, and diesel fuel burns black. And it was, again, it was, for a guy like myself, it was awesome. It was just incredible. You just seeing this stuff, and there is no fog of war in battle. That's a political statement. There's no such thing. Guys that are in it, things are vivid. The orange is the most orange you've ever seen. The green is the most green you've ever seen. Your ears are picking up everything, and it's incredible. And all we're thinking about is we got to link up. We got to find the ambassador. We got to clear this compound. And that's what we did. And we're clearing. Six of us are clearing 8-acre compound with four different buildings trying to find everybody. And again, the book goes into a lot greater detail. I got to skip a lot. But we did manage to clear the compound. All the State Department guys were in different parts of the compound in different buildings, and we all split up, and we managed to clear them and get them all out. In the meantime, Ty and Jack, the two angels of the team, they're in there running in and out of the burning villa trying to find the ambassador. And that thing is on fire, and it's hot. And I remember going in there a couple times myself, just hitting the door and just – it just hitting you back because it's so bleeping hot in there. It's like a pizza oven with diesel fuel, so you can't breathe. Well, I remember going out, finding Alec, getting him cleared out of his little area, going and getting classified information, all that classified stuff. And I remember a call come across the radio, says, we lost one. I'm like, how do we lose one? And I remember I saw Dave. He goes, Dave comes up to me and says, yeah, we lost one. I said, well, who do we lose? So we lost the IT guy. Well, that's when we lost Sean. Sean Smith. And Jack and Dave Ubin had managed to find him back in the back area where the safe room was, and they pulled his body out. And let Jack being the angel he is, we knew he was dead. Somebody's died of smoke inhalation. He'd been in that smoke for over an hour. And but Jack still tried to resuscitate him because you could just tell that just that morale builder of for the State Department guys that had just been really left to die. They needed it, and Jack tried, even though we knew he was dead. And again, it's just dealing with adversity. You want to give up. Like, we lost one. Nobody's helping us here. Even our own people are trying to stop us from coming over. We still need to fight this out because we don't know when this is going to end, because we didn't. We had no idea when it was going to end. Well, we get Sean, say a prayer over his body. Our team leader, who ended up getting the star for bravery that night, waited till we cleared the compound, and he drove a car up. And so he drove a car up. I put Sean's body in the back of it, myself and Ty, set a prayer over Sean's body, closed the door, and went back to trying to find the ambassador. And it got so bad, the smoke was so bad, that we were actually basically doing tag teams. Somebody would run in as far as they'd take a deep breath, and they'd run as far as they could, then run back out, tag hands, and the next guy would do it. Because you could not hold your breath long enough. And the flashlights, if you've ever been in smoke, you firefighters know this, or anybody that's been in smoke before, that diesel fumes, you put that flashlight on it, all it's going to do is reverberate back, and you're not going to be able to see. So basically, you're going in blind, and we almost lost Ty there. Ty got lost in the back, and we had to play Marco Polo with him and just run in the black smoke and grab his hands, basically do a monkey chain to grab and pull him out. Well, as I come out the second time and we got the State Department guys loaded up, we think we got all their equipment. It's around 11:45 now. We've been on the compound now since the initial attack. It's been 2 hours and 15 minutes. There's a huge explosion on the backside of the villa. And I look back and there's a 17 Feb guy. At least I think there is. I can't tell if he's 17 Feb or not. You can't tell enemies and friends over there. It's really hard, especially when there's no uniforms. And he's running by and his hand's gone. And I was yelling, going, what's going on? What's going on? I looked at one of our guys that spoke English, a local guy, young kid that spoke a good bit of English. I said, hey, what happened? And he says, hey, grenade. And well, what I assume this guy was, because we didn't know if he was friendly or not, that he tried to cook off a grenade. A grenade is where you hold it, count to two, throw it, so your guys can't throw it back at you. And so I figured he tried to throw a grenade at us, and it blew up in his hand. And again, I'm not sadistic. I'm not telling that. I just, hey, don't throw a grenade at us anymore. Okay, it serves you right. Don't do that. You know, go drink some water, rub it off. You'll be good. Get back in the game. Well, second explosion hit, and this one almost knocked me on my butt. And I'm like, oh, that's RPG. And I remember I turned the corner, and just like a water faucet turned on, the snaps all of a sudden just picked up. Snap, 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 and it just starts snapping because there's bullets going right by your head. Now, we've been through a lot so far, and all I can think about now is, man, they're shooting they're shooting us again, but I felt protected. I know God's out there. I know he is. I've been through situations like this before. You know you're not going to get hit. You feel warm inside. You know that somebody's looking out over you. And I'm out in the open just like this, and all I did is I turned around and I just started shooting back at what was shooting at us. I knew I wasn't going to get hit. Also, the training, knowing that they didn't have night vision, and at night, if you don't have night vision and you've never been trained right, you're going to shoot high. And the snaps were all a couple feet high over my head. That's good enough. Couple feet, you know, inch, 5 inches, 2 feet, 5 feet, they're still missing you. And I remember I just turned around and I just started shooting. I got out in the open and I'm just plugging away. And I remember my right eardrum blew out. All of a sudden, it, blam, like, that hurt. I'm still shooting. Now I'm halfway deaf anyway from over the years, but that really did hurt. But I didn't skip a beat. I'm still shooting at everything that's shooting at us. Put my laser down range, and I turn, look like this, and there's this, again, this is crazy. This is war. This is, you'll see some of this craziest stuff you'd never thought you'd see before. There's this little Libyan, and he's in a button-down shirt, nice button-down shirt, nice slacks. He's got some nice shoes on. He's got this nice AK, and he just smiling, he's shooting with me. He just showed up out of nowhere. Like, what in the world? Like, this is the coolest. And again, it's those little things. Man, it just motivated me. I was like, holy kid, this is awesome. This guy's out walking his dog, because that's what you do. You go in Libya, you walk your dog, you walk it around, and then, oh, hey, there's a firefight. I got my AK. Let's go get in it. And he got in it. But it was awesome because, you know, I guess it's my little Libyan angel, because I never saw this guy again. I don't know what happened to him. Never, but he's gotten down the fire. And I remember pulling my offhand off. Always pull your offhand off the gun so you can still shoot. So even though I'm not hitting anything, I'm shooting. And I say, hey, I need some help. And immediately Dave comes around the corner. He starts laying hate downrange. And then Tig's the bravest out of all of us that night. Tig did the most remarkable things that night. He climbs up on top of the villa that's on fire. And he starts shooting down at the same area. What had happened is whoever the local force was that was there, they had opened up a back gate, and that's where they were counterattacking us from. And the weirdest thing, again, this is combat. Sometimes it works out like this. Sometimes it doesn't. The RPG gunner that kept shooting at us came around the corner too many times, and we hit him. And as soon as he dropped down, it was like the water faucet turned off. The firing just stopped. So it's surreal things that happen. And you don't sit there and think about it until like 2 years after. It's like, okay, it's done. Let's get ourselves out of here because we need to get ourselves fixed. Now, the media, you don't get this from the media. In that same time frame that we were getting counterattacked, the State Department guys, we got them in their vehicle. We sent them along their way. We told them if they were going to leave, make sure you go left. Don't go right because there is a terrorist house that is 200 meters from your house. And they have been watching you guys for months. And they reported that up to higher in their chain of command with the State Department. I can't tell you where that went to. I don't know. But they got attacked, and they got hit very, very hard. They got ambushed going back to our compound from the consulate. People don't know about that. And they're very lucky that they lived, because their car came back to our compound chewed up with AK-47 PKM fire, which was point-blank range. Run flats were flat. literally. And I remember asking Scott when we got to Germany, like, how did you guys live for that? He said, the RPGs missed us. They kept shooting high. And it's just another one of those things that now you got the full story. Now you know that there was actually other things that were going on and that we were actually in some pretty serious firefights there. We fought off that attack where they were trying to retake the consulate, and now it's close to midnight, and we can't find the ambassador. And this actually really still hurts me to this day, because as a Ranger, and every other service has a creed of this too, but as a Ranger, you never leave a fallen comrade to fall in the hands of the enemy. Never. And we couldn't find the ambassador. And we had almost lost Ty in that smoke field. We just got counterattacked. We can't get all the way to the back of the safe room because they're still on fire and there's too much smoke. We're actually crawling on our bellies trying to get back to back areas. And I'm like, well, what do we do? State Department guys are gone. We think we've got all classified. We got Sean Smith's body. We don't even know if the ambassador's still there or they got him. Our compound's going to get attacked pretty soon, and it's lightly defended as well. And we made a decision, and we left. Now, the ambassador was found there at 1 o'clock the next morning when the smoke died down and the fighting moved to the annex. And but so he was there, and it bothers me because we left him. And I still think we could have saved him if we would have disobeyed orders earlier. So I still take the blame. Some of the other teammates, I still blame myself for him dying. But actually, I'll deal with that forever. It's part of war. It's what it is. Anyway, we get back to the annex, and we know we're going to get attacked. And immediately, my nods had broken, and I remember I ran back into our annex, our Villa C, to get me a new set of night optical devices, night vision goggles. And I remember I had found you won't get this on the news either. I'd found a BlackBerry in the fire there at the consulate, and I didn't know who it belonged to, and I thought it was maybe the ambassador's, and I think maybe we could track him down with this. And I remember going in to Villa C, and I remember seeing our leader chief of base, Bob, and you guys can't see me, and I probably won't be able to get back up, but he's sitting there like this. Now, maybe that's the special operations thing in me. Maybe that's just how as a leader, you shouldn't act. But he showed like he was defeated. And we had been through so much adversity so far. You can't show that you're defeated to your subordinates. And it disgusted me. It made me sick. Actually, I wanted to punch him in his face. But military bearing kicked in. I had a good Lieutenant Colonel. Lieutenant Colonel McChrystal. General McChrystal was my first battalion commander. Fantastic leader. And military bearing kicked in, and I remember I got the phone out. I tossed it to him. I said, hey, you might want to check this out. There might be ambassadors. I'm out. And I never talked to him again the rest of the night. Went and got my night vision, got back up on the roof, and right when I got back on the roof, there's movement coming towards our compound. Small little group. There's about 10 guys. And they're starting to move from the east side of our compound, what we endearingly called zombie land, because it looked like a place where you'd see zombies coming at you. There were sheep, goats. There were goat Kwanzaa huts. It was just a barren area, and it was an affectionate term for it. And they're moving on us. And I remember getting back up to the top of the roof, and I see DB, and Dave goes, hey, dude, there's guys moving. I said, well, do you see guns? He goes, no. Got my nods down. We're looking out. We got lasers out. And I remember looking at Dave going, dude, we can't shoot. And actually, we do talk like this, dude. He'll start saying dude a lot more. Doesn't matter. Because they're moving from a house that their kids actually lived in. There was a family that lived in a house. And, of course, true terrorist fashion, they're using that house to stage from because they know we're not going to shoot it up. Because there's kids in there. There's kids from 6 to 16 in that house. Because they would come out, and just like kids do, they would play outside. They loved firecrackers there. They'd throw firecrackers over our walls. I would do the same thing. They're just kids. But they're using that house, and we don't know if there's still guys out there playing hide-and-go-seek. And I like, Dave, we can't do anything until I see guns. Well, in the meantime, they're starting to move like they're bad guys. And I remember calling the radio to our team leader going, hey, I need a sit rep. What do we got? Do we got friendlies coming to us? Do we have bad guys? What communication do you have? Because we figured maybe 17 February, February were still our friends, and they were coming to surround and secure our compound. And we got the report from our leadership that they didn't know. We don't know. We're checking on it. I'm like, guys, they're moving on us right now. They're 50 meters from us. I need to know. Well, we're checking on it. Yeah. obviously we're not going to get our support that we needed there, so that's fine. So I said, Dave, and Dave is awesome. Being a MARSOC Force Recon Sniper, that guy had eyes like a hawk. I'm like, Dave, if you see a gun, let me know. And I'm getting on the radio with Oz and Tig because they're in a fighting position on their interlocking sectors of fire, saying, hey, guys, you see movement? Oz sees it. He said, Oz, I got it. Oz tells me, he goes, Tano, I got it. I start lasing guys. We have IR lasers, infrared lasers, and I start pointing at guys. And again, that's, if you guys haven't seen that, that's some of the coolest things. I mean, you see in those light shows, and it's just like the movie, seriously. And Oz goes, I got it. And again, because we were a good team, because we got along with her, because we could deal with adversity together, I didn't need to say much. I just said, Oz, you see my laser? Roger. See it, Roger. And it's just, it's like an airplane, the airplane movie. Roger, you know, over Unger. Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. But it's a great feeling because you know and you trust your guys that are around you. Finally, a guy gets about 40 meters from Oz's position, and Dave goes, I got a gun. I got an AK. I relay it to Oz. Oz, there's AK, guy 40 with this right next to your position. And right then, we see a little fizz come across the fence. You can see it in your nods. It's just a little, something that looked like a Wile E. Coyote bomb. It's that little shh. And it comes over. What it was is a gelatina bomb. And what they use those for is that basically it's a kind of like sticks of dynamite in a bag. And then they light a fuse and they use it for fishing, redneck fishing. You know, they drop it in the ocean, it blows up. It's just on a bigger scale, and they blow up in the ocean. And that's, but they use that as a flashbang, and they threw it over the top. They use it to basically to blind and to surprise and disorient. They threw it over the top, and it exploded. And all that was to us was that was a signal to let him off, let him have it. And we tore him up. And when you're shooting with nods, you can see every splash of that bullet when it hits. Every time it hits, you're seeing the heat exploding, and you're seeing the lasers bounce. And I know some people in this crowd may know, may not know. If you ever you've been to a rave or a techno, you know, the lights, it's a lot cooler than that. It's just the neatest because you're just picking people off. And it's not that you don't have remorse for them. It's just, hey, we didn't start this. We didn't attack you guys. We didn't ask you to come to our compound. Now you're trying to kill us. So now we're going to do what we have to defend our keep because I'm going home to see my kids. And we are good at what we do. And we are working well together, and we took them out. We hammered them. Very easy, actually, because we knew what we were doing, and we could defend ourselves. Well, we got through that. We're feeling pretty good about ourselves. We still haven't found the ambassador. We don't know where he's at. We have no idea that he's been found. 2-3 hours of self-reflection go by where you're trying to think of your family. You're thinking about the last, but you don't want to hold on to that. You don't want to say, man, I hope I get out of here. I don't want to die in this dirty air. I think what I think about is my last conversation with my family was good. We said our love yous. I'm good. Get out of your head. I got a job to do. And the rest of the guys are like that too. Well, come around 3 o'clock, we get attacked by a bigger force. And this is the same thing. I'm going to let the book explain this better for you because I don't want to lack of time. But approximately 30 guys start moving on, same area. And I remember I'm in my head going, man, these guys are just dumb. I can't believe they're doing this again. They're coming the same way. And this time, I just get comfortable. I just get on the parapet, and I just rest. And I'm just, all right, whenever you guys are ready, they're coming. And they move. And I got this sector of fire. Oz has my 6. And I see a guy out of the corner of my eye coming around a vehicle. And he has his hand cocked back. And my first instinct is to turn and shoot him. But if I turn and shoot him, then I'm going to leave Oz's 6 uncovered. So we do what we're trained to do. He's got my 6. I trust my buddy. And Oz, rightfully so, he nailed him. The guy fell back. Explosion. He was going to throw a grenade at us, and he exploded, and it was on again. And we just, we took him out. It was an incredible light show again. This was a little bit bigger. And you're zipping him up. You're peeling him. You're hitting him. You're nailing him. And you're seeing him turn tail and run. Or you're seeing him fall. One thing about NATO ammunition that's terrible, sometimes that green tip doesn't always tumble right, so it'll go through somebody. It goes fast, and I'm just explaining it to you. I'm not, again, I'm just saying this is what happens. When that ammo goes through somebody and it doesn't tumble, it's going to kill him, but it's not going to kill him right away. And when you're in a firefight, you want to see that guy go down, and you want to see him stay down. So when you hit him and he gets back up, gosh, I got to hit him again. And it was getting kind of frustrating, but at the very least, at least we were knocking them off. We're getting them off our objective, and we're taking them out. Now, I'm not a big scorekeeper, but I know I may get asked this question, so I'll tell you now. We had an unofficial body count of 40 that we actually took out. I can't corroborate that. Honestly, I don't care. All I know is that we defended our compound and we got them off. Again, the book goes in a lot greater detail, those firefights. I'll let you read that if you want to read it. Well, about this time, the Tripoli team, which had Glenn Bub Doherty, had finally got to our compound. Now, the media doesn't tell you this. They actually came from Tripoli, got on a Benghazi's airport at midnight. They had to rent a plane. I think it was $20,000 to rent a plane to fly to us. Our own GRS guys with two Delta Force operators and one interpreter. Delta works with us occasionally on sites. They flew over. They got to, because they didn't know Benghazi and because we didn't have a militia, which is a complete intelligence failure, we didn't have a militia that was friendly to us. They had to sit and wait on that compound, even though they were only 10 miles away from us, for 3 hours to finally get a ride to us. So our support was sitting there at Benghazi Airfield, Benina, for 3 hours before they could actually get to us. They finally did get to us. And they get to us around 4 o'clock. And out of all the guys that came, Glenn is the only one that went up to the top of the Villa C to assist. I mean, the rest of us have been up there all night. You don't just come. I know how the politicians like to say there was lulls and firefights and there's breaks. There's no break. Once you get in a firefight, it's not like I can say, oh, time out. Yeah, quarter's over. I'm going to go downstairs, have a beer. You know, call me in 5 minutes. I'm going to come back up. When you're getting in a firefight, you're staying up there. And you're watching and your mind is going crazy, but you're trying to keep it all together. Well, Glenn climbs up to the roof. The rest of the guys, including the Delta Force guys, go into Villa C. And he's up there for about 5 minutes, seeing Ty. Ty's up there. Mark's up on that same roof, Oz and Dave Ubin. So we have four guys up on Villa C. And I hear a phoom. Now, I had actually got this eardrum blown out as well from DB because we were shooting so close together. In fact, I'm supposed to wear hearing aids, but I'm going through a divorce, so I don't like to hear much. Anyways, I don't wear them. That's true story. I'm callous, aren't I? I'm just a pig. I swear I am. Seriously, I don't like to wear them. I do like the sound of the seashell, the ocean in my ears. I look, because I like not being able to hear. Anyway, I couldn't really tell what it was, but my body motions went like this. I flinched. So it was something. I remember I got on the radio and I kind of half questioned it. I go, mortars, just like that. And all of a sudden, a huge explosion hits on the back of Villa C and a whole firefight lights up on the back of Villa C. And all I see is Tyrone turn around and my nods. He's got his machine gun and he just lets it go cyclic. And which basically he pulls his trigger back and he doesn't let it go. And you just hear it buzz. It's just bzzz. And again, it's awesome. Mark gets into it. I turn around, and I don't even know what I'm shooting at because I'm trying to shoot over the top of them. But I do know from training, you keep people's heads down. You put bullets down range, and I just turn around, and I'm just shooting over their heads. DB's doing the same thing. Second mortar hits, and I see a guy go down. Dave actually got hit. The mortar hit the backside of Villa C. He got hit in the face. He comes down. He says, I'm hit. He's out. Third mortar hits. Fourth mortar hits. Fifth mortar hits that quick and it gets silent up on that roof. And I remember looking on that roof, seeing the smoke come up, and I've been through mortar attacks before. And I remember thinking to myself, man, he just lost them. I knew they were dead. I knew somebody was dead. And it got quiet. Except me and DB still were trying to shoot. So was Jack. We're still trying to shoot it if there's targets out there. In the meantime, the militia that escorted the Tripoli guys over, they take off. I hear their tires squealing. They take off in the direction of the mortars. What I didn't know, and God blessed us that night, one, their leader had actually walked into Villa C, and he got caught in that mortar attack, and he was able to call, I believe it was the Libyan Shield Militia, to go take out that mortar team. And I could hear him fighting in the back. I could hear firefighting, squealing tires a couple miles away. And if we had not had them there, we would have got mortared and we would have died. We couldn't fight it. Even though I'd asked for a Spectre gunship at 937, I asked for a Spectre gunship and air support at midnight, and I asked for a Spectre gunship air support or any support at all at 3 o'clock. Three different times I asked for it. I cannot tell you where that ended up or who stopped it from coming or if it even was relayed up, but it was asked for. And that's why it asked for it. Well, again, Tig, being the hero that he is, and Tig is out of all of us, I said Tig is the hero. Tig gets up. He doesn't know if we're going to get mortared again, and he doesn't care. He gets up on that roof, and he sees carnage everywhere. Dave's arm and leg are basically severed off. They're hanging by tendons. Oz, I can see Oz still trying to get up and get his round, get his weapon up, and I keep seeing it fall. He's like trying to do this. And I got my nods on, but I can't realize, like, what the heck's going on? Well, finally, get a glimpse of it, his arm had severed off. He didn't realize it. So Ars is a tough dude. Me and Oz have our problems together, but that man is tough. He didn't even know that his arm's basically gone. So when he's trying to get his gun up, it's falling down because his arm's just flat. And he's still trying to shoot. Tig gets him, sets him down. He's like, dude, stop it. You're going to hurt yourself. Oz sits down, and Oz is going into shock. Ty and Glenn died instantly. They had died. That third mortar hit, and they had overpressure of their hearts, and it just they died. Well, I remember Tig telling me that he turned around, got the tourniquets on Dave, and they turned around, and Oz is sitting down, still playing with his arm. I remember Tig laughing. Tig said he laughed at him and said, stop playing with it. You know, stop it. You know, it was still very, very dark. Tig's got nods on, and he's putting tourniquets on these guys, and he saved their lives. He got tourniquets on them and stopped the blood flow and saved them. And, no, these guys, if you ever see Oz, I call it Oz's his tiny hand. Oz's hand is actually smaller now, and I get kind of grossed out when he touches me, like, with it right here. It's his tiny hand. But saying it was – they were very severe injuries, and Tig saved their lives. Under fire – and under possible mortar fire. And I remember Tig going, getting up on the roof and saying, hey, I need some help up here. And we got two Delta Force operators. We got three GRS guys still in Villa C. Myself, Jack, and DB are the three guys left that are trying to hold the compound. And Tig's waiting, and we're waiting. And finally, Tig, 5 minutes later, he goes, I need some effing help on this roof. And finally, DB goes, I'm coming. I'm like, Dave, you can't. I got on the radio, Dave, stay. You got to stay. You got the best fighting position. I'll go. Finally, somebody rogered up in the Villa C. And I don't know if it was a Delta guy or one of our GRS guys says, we're going up. We'll help. And they finally came up. Now, keep in mind, Delta Force operators, one got the Distinguished Service Medal. The other one got the Navy Cross. Well, we finally got the Libyan Shield after that attack. The Libyan Shield came with a 50-car motorcade, huge, biggest, baddest game in town, and they surrounded our compound with a bunch of Hiluxes, with technicals, and they locked it down, finally, at 6 o'clock the next morning. And I remember looking at Dave. We're still up on the roof. We're still holding security while they're pulling. And I'm like, man, where were these guys at 9:30? Holy crap. I need these guys. And it was more of a joke than anything. You know, I was telling jokes all night. Anyway. It was something that I said that night. I'm just trying to keep the mood light. I mean, things are happening. Adversity's happening, but you still have to fight through it because you don't know when this is going to end. And my sense of humor is my defense mechanism, and that's why I'm trying to keep everybody on their toes and not get down on themselves. I mean, we just lost two of our best friends. It's still not over. We don't know when we're going home yet. We don't know if anybody's coming. Well, they locked the compound down, and we finally start to mobilize and get our stuff to get to Benina, thinking that maybe there's going to be a ride there at Benina. Now, again, you don't get this from the media, but the book will tell you this. I remember that I was hearing voices, and I do hear voices all the time anyway, but I was hearing voices out in this field out in front of me, and I remember pointing to the Libyan Shield commander going like this, which means bad guys, and he caught it. I said, there's bad guys in that field. And I remember he pulled a team out. I covered them from my overwatch position, and they pulled two guys out of there that weren't supposed to be there. And they put them in flex cuffs, and they disappeared. And I remember asking Congress when I did my testifying, and I remember asking the agency, what happened to those two guys, and nobody could ever tell me. So we got two spotters that somehow got arrested and then disappeared. But in the meantime, too, after that, I finally get down off the roof, and we still have to get Ty and Glenn's bodies down. Ty's a big guy. I said he looked like Leonidas. Glenn was a CrossFit guy. Glenn's a big guy, too. Well, You don't get this in the media, and this is why I'm telling you. It's not something that's easy to hear, but it's just another piece of adversity that we had to deal with that night, and then we had to get through it. Tig is going to go and try to carry him down, but we don't have stairs in those buildings. We have makeshift ladders on the outside that we made, that we built. They're not real sturdy. Tig says, well, hey, let's go get it. We used to pull a tire around for PT, for physical training. We pull a tractor tire around the base with a, and it wasn't a big tractor tire. It was a little one. I'm not that big. But we had a tow strap, and we were going to, basically Tig goes, let's get the tow strap and lower him down, because there's no way we're going to be able to carry him down. And the two Delta guys go to Tig and says, no, we'll get it. So Tig thinks that, well, it's Delta. They must have some special gadget, you know, little thing in their pocket. They push a button. It's a little helicopter that comes out, picks them up, and get them out. Well, the Delta guys get up on top of the roof, and I remember Tig telling me that he turned around, and all they can see is them rolling Ty's body off the side of the roof. Man, and I'll tell you what, if you ever hear your friend's body come off the side of the roof and hit the ground, hit the sidewalk, it's one thing that you'll never get out of your head. And Tig's kind of in shock. So was I. So was Jack. Jack saw it too. And I'm like, what just happened? And before we knew it, they were doing the same thing to Bubs. And Bub hit. Bub's stomach split open when he hit. And it's just, you know, what else could go wrong? What else do we need to go through this night from our own people and from the bad guys? And like I said, just keep in mind the two D-boys that didn't fire a shot that night. One got the Distinguished Service Medal. One got the Navy Cross for bravery. It's okay, though. Medals, you can't do anything with them anyway, but throw them in a tough box. Well, I remember Tig, and Tig's pretty, Tig is the most shook up about that. First of all, because Tig did the most to save lives up there, but also because he's the one that was the closest to it and saw it most vividly. Remember, we got Ty and Bub's body on a flatbed. You know, Ty's head, I remember picking up the back of his head, and it was kind of mushed. Remember saying a prayer over him, though, and we didn't have body bags, so we just had sheets. We just put sheets over him, and we headed out to Benina Airfield. And we got out of the compound. And at about 6 o'clock that morning, that was the consulate and the annex ceased to exist. They were gone. We headed to Benina. No altercations going to the airport. Again, we weren't going to get attacked. We were a monstrous motorcade. It was very impressive. And we get to the airport. And I remember the plane that they had rented from Tripoli, they failed to tell the pilot and the flight attendant that what they were coming there for. So the flight attendant was actually in her uniform with their little hat. And I remember, this is funny. I remember Oz getting out of the vehicle, and Oz is dripping blood. He's got his tourniquet on, but he's bleeding. You know, he's got puncture marks all everywhere. And, you know, Oz is tough Oz cowboy. He goes, I walked into this country, I'm going to walk. You know, he used to break bulls. I walked into this country, I'm going to walk out. And I remember he gets out of the car, and I can't make that up. That's actually what he said. And he walks out of the car, and he's bleeding, and man, that lady's flight attendant's eyes look like Looney Tunes. I swear they came out this far. And I just laughing. It's like, this is great. This is too funny. And she runs into the back of the plane, and we're thinking, well, maybe she's going to get something to help him on, or maybe she's getting a pilot. No, she runs out. She's got towels, and she's throwing towels over the whole plane to make sure he doesn't bleed all over it. We get Dave, and Dave's a big guy. Dave's about 6'3", 230. And Dave's messed up. He can't walk. He's out. He's bleeding out. And we had to walk him up the stairs and finagle him into the little door. Because it's like a regional jet, like you're flying like a little United Express. Well, it gets to be about 7:30, 8 o'clock, and we get all the non-shooters on. We get all our severely injured on. They take off. They head back. The rest of us shooters, we're sitting there and waiting, and we're getting word that the bastard has been found and he's going to be coming to us, which happened. About an hour later, 9 o'clock is the ambassador's found that he's brought to us. I inspect his body. And just so you all know, the ambassador, what I saw, he was not tortured. He was not drugged. I actually looked at his body. First of all, and also I wanted to make sure the body bag wasn't full of IEDs. And he looked fine. He looked like he had died of smoke inhalation. So that's just what I saw. Well, it gets to be 10 o'clock now. And there's still nobody showing up for us. I'm like, what the heck is going on? I go up to our country team leader, who's a really good guy, solid guy, ex-Marine. And I said, hey, man, are we leaving or what are we doing? And he says, I'm checking on, I don't know. It's 10 o'clock, 10:30. We finally see a C-130 a cargo plane come and land at Benita Airfield. It's landing, and I'm like, well, crap, better late than never. You know, God bless America. They're finally here. And that plane lands, and I'm looking at the tail boom, and it's a Libyan flag on the back. Like, well, maybe the State Department contracted with Libyan people to Libyan Air Force to come get us. And it stops, it lands, it starts to go by, and I'm thinking it's going to taxi, stop, turn around, lower its rear hatch. We're going to run in, and it's going to fly out. They're not going to do a cold load. They're going to do a hot load so they don't waste gas, because that's what you do. That's what we do. And it's just like a movie. It's like a Western movie. They just were standing at the train depot, and that train just goes right on by us. And we're looking, going, okay. I remember I looked at our TL, and I went like this. And we had a good interpreter that came from Tripoli, solid guy. One of the best interpreters / case officers I've ever been around. And he runs over there. They get in a truck. They drive over to about a 3/4 mile where the plane parked, shut its engines off. And they talk to the Libyan Air Force pilot there, and they talk him into turn his gears back on, turn the plane back on, turn around and flying us out. So that plane wasn't intended for us. And because we're blessed, because we didn't panic, we dealt with the adversity, we dealt with the hand that was given to us, we managed to get them to get their plane around and pick us up, and we got out of there. And that was it. That was it. That was in a nutshell. That was Benghazi. That was how it rolled. Now, I don't want everybody to walk out of here or think that on a downer, because I'm not. I would go back there in a heartbeat because of the teamwork that you just don't get anywhere else, or the experiences to how to handle adversity, because I can handle pretty much anything now that's dealt at me. Yeah, believe me, I've had to in the last year and a half, and I'm sure as the election gets closer, I'm still going to have to even more. I just want people to realize that there are still guys out there that are willing to sacrifice their lives to protect. And there's ones that were before us that were a lot tougher than us that we learned from. Anyway, I just want you to know that, guys, I really appreciate you coming and even hearing me speak. And I live 5 minutes down the road. I live here. I'm from Omaha. Well, I am from Omaha now because I'm a Husker fan, so obviously I'm from Omaha now. I've been here since 1996. So just take away that there are a lot of positives that went happen that night. Also take away that now you know what happened on the ground. And take away from here that there are guys like myself that are still thankful that people like you are willing to come out and hear a knuckle dragger like myself tell a story. And I just want to say, I just can't say thanks enough, because it took me a long time to pull myself up by my bootstraps and want to talk about this. Now you can't shut me up, but... But I just want to say thank you again, and thank you for having Ms. Ashton. I appreciate it. I want to say thank you. Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Chris Paranto, former Army Ranger, 2nd Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment. Mr. Paranto was in Benghazi as part of the CIA Annex security team on the night of September 11, 2012, when it came under attack by Islamic terrorists. His story is told in the book 13 Hours in Benghazi, written by Mitchell Zukov and co-authored with Paranto and his surviving Annex security team members. This program, presented by the Washington County Historical Association and Patriotic Productions, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, June 2, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Julie Ashton, Director of the Washington County Historical Association, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.